Evans versus Chalmers, and Mr. Vattis, be happy to hear from you, sir.
May it please the court, my name is Michael Vattis. I represent the City of Durham defendants. I'm accompanied by my colleague Leah Quadrino and also other co-counsel for the city and for the individual defendants in this case. As the court knows, this argument involves Evans, and the next argument involves McFadden and Carrington, which are the rest of the 2006 Duke Lacrosse team. In this argument, I'd like to focus, given the limited time, on three issues. First, why the prosecutor's decision to seek an indictment breaks the chain of causation between the alleged police actions in this case and the alleged injuries. Second, I'd like to talk about the stigma plus claims, the alleged false statements, and the due process claim that is a result of that. And finally, on the alleged supervisory liability. This case is fundamentally about whether police investigators and their supervisors can be held civilly liable for the arrest of plaintiffs when the arrest occurred only after the prosecutor decided to indict and the grand jury did indict the plaintiffs. Their claims run into a central problem, which is that according to their own allegations, the investigators were completely candid with the prosecutor and turned over all of the evidence they had, both exculpatory and incriminating. The prosecutor then decided, despite the alleged problems with the evidence, to seek an indictment. Under North Carolina law, it's embodied in the Constitution, under longstanding North Carolina case law, the prosecutor is solely and exclusively and independently responsible for deciding when to seek an indictment and deciding what evidence to present to a grand jury. The Supreme Court in the recent Rayburg v. Polk case also underscored the very different roles that prosecutors and investigators play. It said that the investigator, quote, does not make the decision to press criminal charges. Instead, it is a prosecutor who is responsible for the decision to present a case to a grand jury. It would be anomalous to permit a police officer who testifies before a grand jury to be sued for maliciously procuring an unjust prosecution when it is a prosecutor who is actually responsible for the decision.
The thing that I think is different about this case, that so it doesn't fit in either category very carefully. We don't have the police officers misleading the prosecutor, nor do we have the police officers acting entirely properly. And I think the argument from the plaintiffs was that there was a conspiracy. And what do you say about that? In other words, we have bad policemen and bad prosecutor, and they're all conspiring together. And as you know, under conspiracy law, the acts of one conspirator are attributable to another.
Yes, Your Honor. It is our contention that allegations of conspiracy do not affect the breaking the chain
and
analysis.
And sort of what do you use to support that?
Well,
proposition.
It's clear from the case law, and it's also clear from the complete lack of case law that plaintiffs can cite.
Lack on either side, though.
Well, I beg to differ, Your Honor. Rhodes v. Smithers from this circuit is...
Okay, I'll give you that.
Right on point.
Rhodes v. Smithers is a district court opinion affirmed in an unpublished opinion. That's the authority you have.
Affirmed, but this court did say that it adopted the well-reasoned memorandum opinion.
So in an unpublished opinion, which we don't regard as precedential authority.
Okay, but it is out there, and I think it's all fours with this case.
You've got that.
I think you've also got the Walker v. Scott decision, which followed Rhodes, where, again, the plaintiff did not mislead the investigators did not mislead the prosecutor, so the prosecutor's decision to take the case to the grand jury broke the causal chain.
Yeah, But do we have, and I'm happy to look at new authority, but I'm looking for a case where I think it's acknowledged that the police officers here were fully informed of the bad problems with bringing an indictment here, but the prosecutor knew them as well. Everybody knows them.
Right.
Okay, now what I'm looking for is something that fits that template.
Okay,
cases with the general proposition that the prosecutor's decision breaks the chain. Because in most of those cases, virtually all of them, the police officers are doing the correct thing.
Well, in case after, Rhodes is the most on point. I will agree with you there. But you do have case after case from multiple circuits, including this one, that say very pointedly that as long as investigators turn over all of the evidence to a prosecutor and they don't mislead him and they don't coerce him, they cannot be held for his decisions. And I think it's important to understand the policy reasons behind that.
Yeah, I think that's where I would be interested in hearing what you have to say about that.
I think we want investigators to be completely candid and completely cooperative with prosecutors. If this court were to establish...
But do we want them to skate then if they do that?
We certainly don't want them to misbehave. But there are other avenues for punishing investigators who engage in misconduct. You have potential criminal liability for perjury, for obstruction of justice, for intimidating witnesses. You have administrative and employment sanctions. And this is what the court in Rayburg talked about, that you have these other avenues. So, and this is throughout the immunity case law, where a prosecutor or a grand jury witness or a judge can engage in severe misconduct and yet not be found liable because of immunity. And the courts recognize that you have immunity in those cases for the bigger policy concerns about not wanting to have public officials acting out of fear of civil liability. And I think the court in Rayburg, this court in Jean v. Collins, talked about those sorts of concerns.
What's the larger public concern here? Pinpoint.
The larger public concern is you don't want to discourage investigators from turning over all of the evidence to a prosecutor. If they're fearful that they're going to be held responsible for his decision to seek an indictment, for instance, they may not turn over all the exculpatory evidence because they don't want to be alleged to have conspired with the prosecutor. They give him the exculpatory evidence. He says, I'm going to indict anyway, which is pretty much what happened here. And if that happens, they could be charged with conspiring. They may not want to give him inculpatory evidence. The bottom line is they may decide they're going to start second-guessing a prosecutor's lawyerly decisions. And I think, as this court has said many times, including, again, the Jean v. Collins case, we don't want non-lawyer investigators second-guessing a prosecutor's decisions. And holding them liable will lead to just that result. They'll be second-guessing the decisions of a prosecutor. And again, there are other ways to hold miscreant investigators responsible and to deter that sort of misconduct that's alleged here.
Any of those other avenues been utilized?
There has been a review here, and there has not been found to be any misconduct by the police.
Where is the prosecutor in all this, Mr. Nifon?
Well,
reading the record, it seems to me that much of the alleged malfeasance fell on his shoulders, and yet you have this very broad net cast. What is the legal posture with respect to him?
Well, Your Honor, of course, we do not represent Mr. Nifong, and we certainly don't condone his conduct. He is a party to this case, and he is an example of the sort of punishment that can be attended to in this sort of instance. He was disbarred. He was actually jailed for his misconduct in this case. So there are sanctions available for misconduct when it is found to have occurred. So he is still involved in this case. He's still a defendant, represented separately, of course.
But I thought he was bankrupt, disbarred.
So
for all practical purposes, the plaintiffs can get no relief from him.
I believe you're correct about the bankruptcy, and he has been disbarred, and again, he was jailed for contempt, I believe it was. But again, he's an example of how there are means of deterring misconduct if it's found. And there are also avenues for protecting the rights of criminal suspects. You have...
Suppose here that the law enforcement officers, we don't know at this point because it's here on a motion to denial of a motion to dismiss, but suppose they were guilty of witness tampering with respect to Pittman and saying, unless you change your story with respect to Mangum, we're going to execute an outstanding arrest warrant. And the manipulation of the DNA report, the allegations here are pretty serious. And what do you do with that? I mean, we just supposed to say, well, no, this doesn't go any farther. I mean,
no, not,
what, how, I mean, what, where does that leave the criminal justice process? Why, tell me why, tell me why a civil remedy is not necessary if malfeasance of the sort of on the part of law enforcement officers on the did take place with respect to Pittman and did take place with respect to the DNA report.
Again, Your Honor, there are criminal liabilities potentially, and there are employment sanctions, and you don't want civil liability for these sorts of allegations because of the effect that would have systemically on investigators. In this particular case also, I think it's worth noting that there's no allegation that Pittman testified before the grand jury or was planning to testify before the grand jury or that the DNA report was submitted.
Where are these allegations being heard? You say there are all sorts of other remedies. Is that just an abstract point, or is this whole situation being aired in some legal forum?
Well, it certainly could be the result of a criminal investigation. I think it's telling that it's not. It could be the subject of administrative sanctions. I think, again, it's telling that it's not. It's very easy to sprinkle a complaint with allegations of conspiracy to try to get around a prosecutor's absolute immunity for what he does to the grand jury or to try to find a deeper pocket. But again, I think it's important not to allow these sorts of claims to proceed when you have a prosecutor who is ultimately the decision maker.
So am I to gather from your argument that for purposes of the motion to dismiss, you're accepting as true the allegations of a conspiracy here?
But yes,
that
you're
actually telling us that this has been looked at by other authorities, internal authorities or state authorities or somebody, and they have found there's no basis for prosecution against the police officers?
I can't tell you that. It's not part of the record, and it's not something that I know. But I do know that 6 years after the events, coming up on 7,
I thought that
there hasn't
you had
been
made
anything.
The statement that it was telling, in your view, I think that was your word,
yes,
that there wasn't any criminal or job-related action taken against these police officers.
Yes, all I was saying now in response to your question was I can't tell you that a prosecutor actually considered and determined, but I do know that there hasn't been any prosecutorial action.
And I guess you're saying
action.
In the same breath that if we should affirm, you would at trial, perhaps not be, or on summary judgment, you wouldn't be accepting these allegations
absolutely
about conspiracy.
Not. We absolutely not. We
so
ha- we
we're
have
only
to
looking at
purposes.
Those for purposes of the motion to dismiss.
Yes, Your Honor.
What you're saying is this is a case of artful pleading, that they're stuck with absolute prosecutorial immunity or something that's very close to it, and you can't pursue that avenue, so the next best thing was to go after the investigators?
Your Honor, I would never use the term artful pleading to describe any of these cases with the 803 pages that we have. But I think your central point I would absolutely agree with. If I can make just two other short points in the minute that I have, regardless of what you think the law should be regarding the prosecutor breaking the chain, I think at the very least it's clear that there should be qualified immunity because given Rhodes v. Smithers, given the complete lack of case law.
Yeah, I don't think qualified immunity gets to a causation question. I thought about that a long time. And you may win on the central argument, but I don't know that qualified immunity helps you with that.
Well, I think it does in the sense that no reasonable officer would know that he was violating the Constitution if he turned over all of the evidence.
Well, if we accept their allegations as true and we say that that does, in fact, give rise to a cause of action, and their allegations are conspiracy, not turning over all the information, but conspiring to frame people, then I don't think qualified immunity, I don't think there's any qualified immunity for that conduct.
Your Honor, I think it does because the subjective intent is completely irrelevant. It's the actions that you look at and whether, looking at it in a very particular way, whether those actions, in this case, allegedly turning over all the evidence to the prosecutor, whether that is something that a reasonable officer would know was unconstitutional.
Turning over all of the information and knowing that the information you're turning over is false. That's the allegation.
And telling the prosecutor. And
that
as Hyman is alleged to have
right.
said, when the prosecutor said, I'm going to indict, Hyman said, with what?
Right.
This is in the complaints. So I think that's the
But I interrupted you. What was your other
point? So my second point, and I recognize my time is up, but on the stigma plus claims, I would merely urge this court to rule consistent with almost every other case out there that a search and seizure does not constitute a cognizable plus. Plaintiffs cite only three cases in the 36 years since Paul v. Davis gave rise to the stigma plus claim in which a court has said a search and seizure can be the plus. This court has never held that. Almost every court that has considered it has said it has to be the deprivation of government employment or something similar. That's obviously not the case here. And I think if you were to find for the first time that a search and seizure can be the plus, you will have a due process claim brought in every case in which a person was investigated and then not convicted. That person would say, not only were my Fourth Amendment rights violated, but in addition, my due process rights were violated because the prosecutor issued a press release or the police issued a press release or made statements to the press. And I think under the Supreme Court's decision in Allvite v. Oliver, we don't want duplicative due process claims being made over what are essentially Fourth Amendment claims about the lack of probable cause. Thank you, John.
Mr. Manning, happy to hear from you.
Yes, may it please the court. My name is Christopher Manning. I represent David Evans and Colin Finnerty. I'm also here on behalf of Reed Seligman. With me today is Ashley Harden, my colleague from Williams & Connolly. We ask the court to affirm the district court's denial of the city defendant's immunity claims, allow the case to proceed. I have a few points to make. One relates to the Rayburg point that Mr. Vadas made. The other relates to his intervening causation argument. I'd like to also rebut his arguments about Rhodes v. Smithers and then address the stigma plus claim and answer any questions the court may have. With respect to Rayburg v. Polk, it's clear that the Supreme Court was not immunizing the type of conduct alleged here. Footnote 1 of Rayburg makes it expressly clear. Of course, we do not suggest that absolute immunity extends to all activity that a witness conducts outside of the grand jury room. For example, we have accorded only qualified immunity to law enforcement officials who falsify affidavits and fabricate evidence concerning an unsolved crime, quoting Buckley v. Fitzsimmons, which is a fabrication of evidence case. So what the court was making clear was it was taking the traditional witness immunity for trial witnesses and applying it to grand jury witnesses, but it was not extending back to pre-testimonial acts of fabrication. There's no immunity for that. That's qualified immunity. No, absolute immunity. It's only qualified immunity. And on the facts alleged here, it's clear there is none. With respect to the city's causation arguments, Mr. Vadas says they accept our allegations as true, but their argument depends on a different factual sequence than what's alleged. They're arguing that there was a complete disclosure to the prosecutor who was not, without saying the prosecutor was involved, and then the prosecutor made an independent decision to go to the grand jury. What happened here was there was investigation up to a point, then there was a meeting with Mr. Nifong, and there was a presentation of what they had found.
This is all going to your claim that there's a conspiracy here.
Exactly. And Mr. Nifong said...
Do you have a case to give us about that?
Sure. In...
Good, because there's not one in your brief. So.
I'm always
interested in new information.
Right. We had thought about it in reading the reply brief, and we went to look for cases along those points. We had cited Zari v. Coffey, which is the Second Circuit case about the prosecutor.
Yes.
Zari relies in part on an 11th Circuit case called Bartz v. Joyner, which is a 1989 case. And in its holding, talked about intervening acts only break the chain of causation in the absence of a showing that, among other things, the court officials, like prosecutors, themselves acted with malice and the police joined them. So the point that the 11th Circuit was making was...
Yeah, but there's a later Second Circuit case that disavows Zari.
But Zari was a different scenario. That was a summary judgment case where the post-seizure identification that was at issue there came after a motion to suppress, and the trial judge had allowed it in after knowing all the facts. So they were saying, look, there was an independent actor who was an intervening cause here.
The question is, I mean, you've The whole criminal justice system depends on fairly free and open communication between police and prosecutors. They talk with one another, they share with one another, they communicate all the time. It's just absolutely basic to the bringing of a case. And you inject civil liability into the midst of that communication between police and prosecutors. Are you going to, you could disrupt the candor of it. You can have police and prosecutors pointing fingers at each other during a subsequent trial. You can have somebody sharing or not sharing or whatever information because they think it is, you know, conceivably exculpatory or inculpatory, or they may not share inculpatory information because they're worried about civil liability of some sort later on. I mean, do you just undermine the entire free exchange of information between police and prosecutor by bringing a suit like this and just driving it right into the heart of the police-prosecutor relationship?
No, Your Honor, I hope there's never another case like the Duke LaCrosse case, because in this case, after there was this candid disclosure, Mr. Nifong using the F word to describe the lack of probable cause, they then, prosecutor and police officers together, acted to fabricate evidence. And if there's anything that's equally, if not more, powerful and important to our system of justice is what you just said, Your Honor, it is that there cannot be fabrication of evidence. And that's what happened here. And there was obviously a conspiracy between Mr. Nifong and the police officers, Mr. Nifong acting in an investigatory capacity.
But then you get to the question of the remedy. Is the remedy some sort of criminal prosecution or some sort of disciplinary sanctions or whatever? I mean, why is the remedy to drive a 1983 suit into this as opposed to prosecution or dismissal from the force or something else? I mean, we could pay a real cost. Whenever you introduce civil liability, it skews incentives. If you leave people alone sometimes, I mean, there's going to be some bad apples, but by and large, they're going to do what's right. Not always, to be sure, but as a general matter. And then you introduce civil liability into the middle of the relationship, and people start playing the odds. And then they start calculating, well, if I give them this, what's that going to mean down the road in terms of a suit against me? And what happens? And then they begin to look at each other as potential adversaries rather than as cooperative partners.
Well, there's always an argument about 1983, in any 1983 action, that an officer acted improperly.
I haven't seen many of these cases. There are some, maybe. But.
Well, I don't think, and I hope there are never cases like this again. I think the closest one is the Jones v. City of Chicago case, where you had officers and supervisory officials involved in the misconduct. And I think the argument here is...
The question I've had about this whole case is whether a hard case makes some really bad law. On the one hand, I think something may have badly misfired here, and that there was a police department that went off the rails. On the other hand, you have to think of what the implications are for deterrence and what the implications are by introducing essentially tort liability into the criminal justice process at this preliminary stage.
Well, there's always been tort liability for fabricators, and this case should not stand for the opposite
proposition.
And
that's Jones.
That's Jones. That's Washington v. Wilmore.
But that's misleading the prosecutor. You don't allege that.
Well, we have Hand v. Gary, which says state actors other than prosecutors may be liable if they join in malicious prosecution by prosecutors.
You don't have a case which imposes liability for this conspiracy theory on the police officers.
No, no. What we have, and they have not cited cases to the opposite. What we have are cases that stand for the general.
Well, they have this one district court case.
Right. Well, but you're right. But in that case, there was evidence. It was a summary judgment decision with no evidence of conspiracy in the record with the prosecutors and with evidence that established independently probable cause on one charge. And on the other charge, no evidence of conspiracy and evidence of full disclosure. So not the conspiracy.
Qualified immunity hits into all this, because basically what you've just said to me is there's no law right on point on either side.
Well, what I think there is, I think there are certainly cases, Bartz v. Joyner, Hand v. Gary, and then there's
the
Seventh
Circuit.
They all
talk about misleading the prosecutor, and you and I have just agreed that there's no misleading the prosecutor here.
No, I think, Your Honor, I believe Hand v. Gary is saying, If the officers join in with the prosecutors in a malicious prosecution,
okay,
they're
is
liable.
There a holding there holding the policeman liable?
No, it's
okay.
Just the statement.
So there's no law directly on, there's no case directly, except for their district court opinion. So where do you put qualified immunity into that picture?
Well, I think Your Honor is correct in that causation is a different issue from qualified
causation
immunity.
Causation is, how can you clearly establish law that they would have known?
They had to have known that there was no fabrication, because we know from Washington v. Wilmore you can't fabricate evidence. The complaint makes clear they fabricated false evidence. Miller makes clear you cannot conceal evidence
of the fabrication.
The fabrication was the false April photo array, the DNA report.
We said it was a false array?
It was a fabricated identification procedure.
How is it fabricated? It was just one that you claim is suggestive, and that's for courts normally to decide evidentiary. So you say police officers are civilly liable because a court later finds that it was suggestive?
Well, I think, Your Honor, this is a different case from the suggestive cases. This is a case where you had a witness they knew was lying based on the allegations in the complaint for a crime that they knew based on the evidence alleged in the complaint had not occurred. They gave her every member of the Duke Lacrosse. I'm sorry.
You said they knew. At some point, did the woman say she was raped?
At one point, she said she was.
All right.
Then on multiple occasions, she said she wasn't.
So that means that a police officer can't prosecute, can't go forward with that case just because they're conflicting? That's why we have Jenks and Brady and all those things at trial.
Right, but there were the body of information, and the reason why Mr. Nifong used the F word to describe their case, the body of information, which included scientific evidence that disproved that the alleged rape had occurred, made clear that she was not telling the truth, and that the officers knew that, Mr. Nifong knew that, and instead of saying, let's shut this down, they said, let's go have her pick out three players. And they went to a DNA lab, and they found out, you know what, the DNA evidence excludes all of them with 100% certainty. And they said, conceal that. In fact, let's put something in the report that says,
What the report said is that they didn't leave any DNA on the scene.
Well, the DNA report.
That's all it could have said. It said didn't match them. That's all that said. It didn't say they were innocent. It said this report cannot determine that those persons left any DNA on that scene. That doesn't say they didn't do it. Now, that's a good conclusion to make, and any defense lawyer would certainly run with it, but that doesn't conclude at all. In the report, that what you have a problem with, and I question is whether or not they didn't put that there. But are they required to put Brady evidence before the grand jury?
They have to put evidence that negates probable cause before the independent decision maker. And
they have to put evidence that negates probable cause?
Evidence, you cannot, under Miller, other cases of this court, you cannot hide facts from the decision maker who's going to decide whether to issue the indictment or to issue
the arrest
warrant.
We're going to make a lot of new law then. You're saying that if the prosecutor talks to a witness, and when they first talked to her, she said, you know, I don't remember too well who it was. And then they put her in a lineup, put her in a lineup the next day, and she clearly identifies the person in a proper lineup. They have to tell the grand jury that this person, the day before, had some question about whether they could identify him. I don't have to do that.
I'm not saying that, Your Honor. I'm saying there's a difference between evidence that might be exculpatory, merely exculpatory, and evidence that negates probable cause, that shows no crime occurred. And what we've alleged in the complaint was that they knew at this point.
But this opens itself up to an awful lot of hindsight in the case of, you know, either a conviction or an acquittal. You can then bring a tort suit with respect to the indictment or some kind of arrest, the seizure that took place after the indictment, and just have a field day. Lawyers can have a field day and say, well, you should have handed over this, or you should have handed over that, or you should have handed over this. It just leads itself to 20-20 hindsight after the conclusion of every criminal case, whether it goes to trial or not. Anytime anybody's indicted and arrested subsequently, then you have, you know, a field day of discovery about what should have been handed over and what shouldn't have been. You could rummage through all that. And what does that, you know, what does that do to this basic building block of communication that the whole system runs on? I have another question about this, because it seems to me a lot of these cases, or a lot of these claims, are a little bit on the far limb. And this due process stigma plus claim, you've got all kinds of circuits saying the Fourth Amendment doesn't supply the plus, that the plus has to be in an employment context, as the Cialito case versus Newport News was. And then you've got Paul v. Davis, which Justice Rehnquist makes perfectly plain that the due process clause is not going to be a font of defamation law. But for whatever reason, you didn't bring a straightforward defamation suit against Addison and Hodge. You brought this due process stigma plus claim. Well, the facts in Paul v. Davis were far more appalling than they were here. The police chief put out a flyer with a particular individual's picture on it and said wanted under the flyer. Here, by contrast, you have general statements by a department spokesman. And what are we going to do? Are we going to sue the spokesman for the Department of State or the Department of Defense under due process stigma plus claim for issuing general statements about the department's position, because you don't think in hindsight that they accurately reflected it? And the reason Justice Rehnquist and Paul v. Davis didn't want that thing constitutionalized is because most state statutes, and certainly the Federal Tort Claims Act in 2630, has an exception to tort claims for defamation suits. You're going to constitutionalize this kind of thing, then it seems to me, by elevating it to a constitutional level, that you're essentially invalidating all of these defamation exceptions for states and the federal government that have waived sovereign immunity for tort liability, but not in the case of defamation. And we go and take this away from the state law of defamation and put it on a constitutional level, the implication of that for the federal statute, for the Federal Tort Claims Act, and for innumerable state statutes are serious. How can a person not even have qualified immunity under those kind of circumstances? General statements, they don't mention anybody's name. And, you know, anytime somebody's later thought to misrepresent a departmental position, it would be, you know, sometimes press secretaries and public relations spokesmen have a hard enough time as it is. They get clobbered when they go before news organizations. We're going to open them up?
All I can tell you, Your Honor, is on the facts of this case, the city argues in its brief that Mr. Addison hadn't talked to anybody before he issued statements about the crime, about the alleged crime, and about the alleged perpetrators and what they had allegedly done, statements that were indisputably false. And it is clear from this court's decision in the Hatfield case that you can make,
but
a speaker can make statements.
The point is, you're talking about a public spokesman here. Okay, a lot of times when you're dealing as with somebody as a public relations officer, they don't give you the full story because they don't want the full story out there. They want you to know, want you to know the full story. You come in there as a public relations officer with half knowledge. Oftentimes, you think a president tells the press secretary everything? No, they don't. And you're going to hold those people liable? You're going to make them go through discovery? You're not even going to give them qualified immunity? And what do we do with a case like Paul v. Davis, which says don't constitutionalize defamation law?
Well, Paul v. Davis said that the posters in that case would have been actionable if they had been connected to a deprivation of a constitutional right. And that's what we have here. And I understand Your Honor's point about not specifically identifying the plaintiffs in those statements, but the Hatfield case answers that question. And Mr. Addison, in terms of qualified immunity, it's not that he got half the story. They're saying in their brief he had no story.
There's no property interest here. There's no employment interest here. You have multiple circuits saying you can't find the constitutional deprivation in the plus in an unlawful search and seizure because it's just phenomenally broad. That's why courts have taken this. And for us to breach that line in the case of statements that don't even mention particular individuals. Now, let me proceed further. In this, you want to impose supervisory liability on several individuals, Mr. Russ and Mr. Counsel, who aren't even mentioned in your complaint. I read the complaint. We're supposed to hold them in. These people weren't even mentioned. If there's some collective responsibility or some collective failing, you get at that through municipal liability and through an errant policy. But I don't see how we're to string up supervisors for monetary damages when the complaint doesn't so much as mention them.
Well, Your Honor, I know my time's up. If it's okay, I'd like to respond to that. The first point I'd like to make is there was another supervisory defendant who was named in our initial complaint, Stephen Mihajich. And the counsel for the supervisory defendants came to us and said he wasn't at the meetings that you've alleged, he wasn't in the chain of commands that you've alleged, and we dismissed him voluntarily from the case. The information that we had leads us to believe that Russ and counsel were with the other supervisory defendants at the key meeting in March that's alleged in the complaint.
Well, that's not in the complaint.
And that they were, Your Honor, it is alleged that there was a meeting in March with the investigators, that the supervisory defendants
people get
were there.
Have the people get named as defendants and not mentioned in the complaint? And
they are mentioned. They're mentioned in the complaint, but they're included in the defined term supervisory defendants. We don't have individual, we haven't named them individually in the paragraphs of the complaint that talk about the collective acts and knowledge of the supervisory defendants. And we understand very well from the district court that on summary judgment, we will have to have a factual basis, an evidentiary basis for each of these supervisors to hold them liable on a supervisory liability theory. But a lot of the information is in the possession of the defendants at this point. But the information that we have leads us to conclude that they were in attendance, they were given knowledge of the underlying acts, and they were falling into the category in Jones v. City of Chicago where they knew
on page 61 of the blue brief, on page 61 of the blue brief, it says, in fact, other than alleging their names and ranks, plaintiffs plead no facts at all concerning supervisory dependents, counsel, and Russ. So how does that survive Iqbal?
That's not true. We do allege about the supervisory defendants' actions, and they're included in the group of supervisory defendants. I think what the blue brief is trying to, the point it's trying to make is we don't make an individual allegation where we say Russ did this, counsel did that. But by including the supervisory defendant group.
Isn't that kind of risky after Ashcroft?
I think Ashcroft v. Iqbal says you've got to have plausible allegations against individuals, and we've got plausible allegations both of deliberate indifference and direct conduct by the entire group of supervisory defendants. We also happen to have some individual allegations against some of them. And we understand that while we're at the motion to dismiss stage now, when we get to summary judgment, we're going to have record evidence about each of these individuals. And if it's like Mr. Mihajich, we have to do what we have to do.
further questions.
No, thank you.
Good. Your Honor, I didn't have a chance. There was Your Honor's question about identifications.
Your time has expired, but
there were just some
we
citations.
Have no further questions. Pardon me?
Okay.
You want to make a final comment? Because we've taken a bit of your time with questions, and I realize that a lawyer ought to have a chance to make his case, so go ahead.
Well, I really appreciate that, Your Honor. There were some cases that do talk about photographic lineups and other types of identification procedures being fabricated, not simply suggestive. And the cases I'd wanted to bring to the court's attention are Good v. Curtis, 601 F3rd 393. That's a Fifth Circuit case from 2010. Jeter, G-E-T-E-R v. Fortenberry, 882 F2nd 167, Fifth Circuit 1989. Brewster v. Shasta County, 29 Federal Appendix 908, Ninth Circuit 2001.
You risked it. You opened the door by citing these cases, and your time was up. So it brings to mind a question. Just one, the lead judge reminded us one area. This case is about, it's nothing, this is a 1983 case. So it's not about a conspiracy. I mean, you can't conspire to do something that's legal. Legal meaning they had an obligation to marshal the evidence and give it to the prosecutor. And you don't like what they did, and perhaps it seems to be a problem with it. But the question of real fabrication is this. Is it unconstitutional to bring a weak case to prosecution?
It's not unconstitutional to bring a weak case. It's unconstitutional to bring a fabricated case.
Oh, yeah. Now, is there any allegation that this lady never said she was raped? Yeah. Is there any allegation that this lady never said she was raped? Listen carefully to my question. Is there, do you allege that anywhere?
We do not allege that she never said that.
All right, so no one is making up or lying about the fact that at some point she said she was raped, correct?
Correct.
Right. Now, if a woman says she was raped by 100 men, I'm exaggerating, but 10 men, and all 10 said, I didn't do it, she has a checkered past, other people say, oh, no, she's this, she's shady and all that. You mean it's unconstitutional for a prosecutor to say, I don't care what the odds are, I believe her, and I'm going to bring a prosecution. That would be unconstitutional?
That's not what we're alleging, Your Honor.
No, no, would that be unconstitutional?
It would not be unconstitutional, but it's not what we're alleging.
Okay. But you're alleging that they didn't give everything that would have been consistent with innocence.
No, not just that, Your Honor, that they, in fact, knew she was lying. At the time they knew she was lying,
and they noticed she's like, is you allege that they were there that night?
Well, I think the key to your allegations is this business about we're in bad trouble in this case.
That's correct.
I'm saying to each other.
Right, and based on the factual allegations of everything that came before, including scientific evidence.
That's a lawyer saying, my goodness, this is a hard case. You mean it's unconstitutional because the lawyer says we're effed. That's a smoking gun. Yeah, okay, we got a real hard job. What does that mean?
Well,
we're not going to make this the Duke case. Whatever we do here today is going to apply to everybody in urban areas and everywhere else in terms of prosecution, all right? And you're saying that we're going to carve out a 1983 and break the chain, break this barrier of qualified immunity because we have a case that you say is weak, that they should have known because this person had other evidence? The question is this: would a reasonable police officer would have known that it would be unconstitutional to bring the case, not whether a reasonable prosecution would have concluded not to bring it. Do you agree with that?
I think, Your Honor, it's the knowledge and the allegations in the complaint that have to be credited at this stage, that the knowledge that she was lying, not just that it was a weak case, but they knew she was lying, that no crime had occurred, based on all the facts that are alleged before that moment.
Give me one that would say that she absolutely knew she was lying. Just give me one.
Well, they have the scientific lab tests that are based, that rule
that
out.
That the client didn't leave DNA?
That none of them left DNA on any of the rape kit items after what was alleged to have been, at one point, a 30-minute long rape with perpetrators who did not use condoms, who ejaculated inside the alleged victim, all inconsistent with that. All inconsistent with her own descriptions when she tried to identify people that didn't match up with the description she had given, with the other eyewitness, Pittman, who said to Kroc nothing had happened. But all of that led to them to come to the conclusion she was lying. And then they went forward to fabricate evidence, including a DNA report that suggests that Mr. Evans contributed DNA to the rape kit items, when in fact that was not true. They knew with 100% certainty he was not a contributor to the rape kit items. That's a fabrication. And he was indicted. And he was seized as a result. And Mr. Finney and Mr. Seligman also were seized as a result of their fabrication.
You have state claim. You can bring state claims for malicious prosecution, can't you?
We have alleged in this complaint.
You know, you can bring state claims in state court, right? You can bring those claims.
Well, we brought them in this action too, Your Honor.
Yeah, but this is a 1983. You had to go by that first, whether or not you're there. Federal constitutional claims, but it's certainly a state North Carolina claims, correct?
We do have those alleged in this complaint as well. Thank you.
Counsel, on that last point, you don't make any assertion here that the prosecutor, that this wouldn't state a 1983 claim against the prosecutor, do you?
No, we've made no such arguments about the prosecutor. And again, we of course don't represent him or condone his misconduct. A few points. Opposing counsel said that the alleged victim in this case said multiple times she hadn't been raped, and a couple of times that she had been raped.
Just one thing. That's because those matters with the prosecutor go beyond in terms of their Brady questions about the prosecutors, you're not?
There are Brady questions when you come to a trial, but the case law is quite clear that there's no obligation to submit exculpatory evidence to a grand jury. I mean, that's the Hornbook law at this point. Just on the factual point, I believe there was only one time the morning after the party where the victim had said she was raped, and then one time she said she hadn't been raped. And then after that point, consistently, she said she had been raped. Now, her accounts of the details were inconsistent, allegedly. But there was only one time very early on when she said she hadn't been raped. Every other time she said she had been raped.
Can I pick up on a point that Judge Gregory made? Because it's an overall, what he said is an overall concern I had about the case, and that is we have so many of these things being federalized. Is there any reason that this case and the basic allegations that are raised here shouldn't be in state court if the federal claims are found either to implicate qualified immunity or the federal claims are found wanting simply on the merits? The state hasn't proved itself irresponsible. The North Carolina Attorney General issued a report that essentially was pretty rough on the prosecution and what happened here. But we have all of these questions of state law, some of which are pretty complicated. There's a question of whether a criminal defendant can raise an obstruction of justice claim with respect to the with respect to investigation or prosecution of him. Well, North Carolina hasn't ruled on that point. They haven't recognized the tort. And why should we go into the question of whether there's an obstruction of justice claim on the North Carolina court? Or why should we, well, can't the malicious prosecution claim and the absence of malice defense be brought up in state court? And then we have questions of whether municipalities have waived their immunity by the purchase of insurance. And that's another question that implicates North Carolina law quite thoroughly. And then we have a further question about the actual place of this article in the North Carolina Constitution, Article Section 19, and that depends on the availability or not of other state cases. So what we seem to have is a case overall that some of the 1983 claims are really inventive. I tried to indicate my serious questions about all this due process stigma plus case, with the plus being a Fourth Amendment claim. But there are questions here about, you know, breaking, about putting 1983 between police, prosecutor, communications. There are questions here that seem to push supervisory liability pretty far after Ashcroft. Why shouldn't the basic justice of the case, you know, Lord knows there's no shortage of state claims here. Shouldn't it be? Is it possible these claims should be in state court? This case should be in state court? Because the state claims seem better grounded to me than many of the federal claims, which raise serious questions about what proper remedies there are and how far we want to push Paul v. Davis and how far we want to push Iqbal. And qualified immunity covers that kind of thing.
Your Honor, I can't explain to you why plaintiffs chose to file in federal court when their federal claims are lacking.
No, but you can explain to us why you've asserted qualified immunity and you haven't said that it should go back to state court for determination of those claims, except for the pendant claims.
Your Honor, this case has been pending for 6 years now, and in the interest of judicial efficiency, to spare the city and the individual officers further costs of litigation, which immunities are supposed to prevent, we would certainly, at this point, prefer that this court address both the federal and state claims and not just kick the state claims to state court, because Lord knows how much longer our clients will be subjected to the burdens of discovery and
but
litigation.
In response to Judge Wilkinson's question, you would concede that we could, if we should conclude that there's no federal claim, we could put all the claims back, state claims back in state court?
You certainly could, but
I... think that those immunity claims, you're entitled to a decision on them right now?
The plaintiffs brought the case in federal court. I think we're entitled to a decision, and I think we so clearly win on the state claims. Perhaps the reason they didn't bring the claims in state court was because the city, which after all is the one with the deep pocket, or deep, I say, in quotes, given the condition of cities today. But I think our governmental immunity case is so strong.
I'm not sure the state claims are all that clear. And North Carolina doesn't have a certification proceeding. So we don't have the luxury of just asking what the North Carolina law is. And we could, you know, there are a lot of unsettled questions of North Carolina law here. And there are unsettled questions of federal law, too, but they're, you know, qualified immunity addresses itself to that. There are an awful lot of cases here that are, an awful lot of these claims are fringe and peripheral and the rest.
But I'm interested in your answer to the question of, is there a problem, a legal problem? I now have heard your preference that you'd like us to determine the state immunity claims. But is there anything that would prevent us from remanding those claims to state court?
I can't think of a legal principle that would prohibit you from doing that. But I do think this case procedurally now is before the court. And I think there are ample grounds for granting the motion to dismiss and granting our motion
for
summary
judgment.
And
you've never asked for it to be remanded?
We have not. If I could make just a couple of other points to respond to counsel's argument. As you said, Judge Motz, Ray in the Second Circuit clearly disavowed Zari or said that it was limited to the very unusual circumstances in which the prosecutor was both the investigator and the prosecutor. And it clearly said in Ray that when police turn all the evidence over to the prosecutor breaks the chain. It's explicit. With regard to counsel's response to Judge Gregory, they use the term fabrication, but there's no true allegation factually of fabrication. The allegations were that the photo array was suggestive, not that they made up the photos or that they made up Ms. Mangum's identification. They just allege it was suggestive. With regard to the DNA report, they don't allege that the results were actually made up. They allege that exculpatory information was kept out of the report. And again, there it's very clear under the case law that there's no obligation to include exculpatory evidence in evidence that's presented to the grand jury under Coakley, Gene v. Collins, and many other cases. With regard to supervisory liability, Judge Wilkinson, I think you put your finger on it. There are numerous references to the collective group.
I want to ask you to wrap it up because okay. I didn't allow him unlimited time and he didn't take unlimited time.
Okay, Your Honor, just my final point. Iqbal and Twombly both say that courts should not just kick a case down the road to the summary judgment stage when the allegations are themselves insufficient, just to give plaintiffs a chance to go on a fishing expedition and maybe come up with evidence. If the allegations are insufficient, as they clearly are with regard to the supervisory defendants, then the case should be dismissed and not allowed to proceed. And here the allegations regarding the supervisors are even less specific than they were in Ashcroft v. Iqbal, where there were specific allegations about the Attorney General and the FBI director. Here there are allegations about supervisory defendants collectively, which are clearly insufficient.
All right, I think all that's in your brief.
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much.